Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture podcast. Today we have an extraordinary guest who I'm so happy to talk to. Ugo Bardi is a member of the Club of Rome, the huge forward-looking report from the 1970s that laid out the challenges facing our complex industrial civilization as the resource base beneath it gradually eroded, or maybe suddenly eroded, depending on how you look at things. He has a recent book, which I have read and absolutely adored, called Exterminations, which analyzed the factors that lead societies to these chaotic, destructive events where people turn on each other. And I would thoroughly recommend you check that out. But I'll throw over to Ugo. He can do a to Ugo Bardi. He can tell you a bit more about who he is and how he reached this point in his life. So over to you, Ugo.
Oh, it's a good question. How did I arrive to this point in my life? Okay, let's see. Where do I start from? I was back 2001. I was in the United States. I was in California working as a chemist at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, as far away as from farming as you could be. And on September 11 of 2001, I saw the fall of the towers in New York on my TV screen on my home. And at that point, I started thinking there's something wrong in my life, because I had been working with crude oil chemistry, oil catalysis, oil refining. Well, as a chemist, I am a chemist basically, and that's what chemists, most chemists, are somehow connected with oil and gas and all this kind of stuff. And at that point, I started thinking, okay, something is wrong. Let's try to understand what is wrong. And I don't think I ever understood it really, but anyway, I made a gallant effort, I should say. So writing books, developing models, trying to use the kind of learning that you have as a chemist. As a chemist, you learn to juggle numbers, to make mathematical models, to figure out how things react with each other, which is chemistry. Chemistry is about how molecules and atoms react with each other. And then you can move, and it's not so different in the way that people interact with each other. Sometimes you have a certain thermodynamic way, willingness to react with other people. And so people sometimes react in an explosive manner, just like chemical substances do. That's what most people who studied chemistry did, that because as a child they loved explosives. That's common. I myself, I did something like that. I never destroyed anything before. But anyway, it's a chemistry is a way to have things react with each other. Something happens. It's an interesting field of science, because it's not very theoretical. It is very practical. You do things, you move things. It's like, in a sense, maybe it's not so unlike the job of a farmer, because a farmer makes things grow. A chemist, maybe the opposite, destroys things. But anyway, it's not so different. So for the past 20 years or so, I've been trying to understand why people do the things they do. And as you mentioned at the beginning of this talk, it's the latest book, the book I wrote, titled Exterminations. It's an outcome of this attempt to try to understand why people do the awful things they do to each other. It's not easy. I don't think I can teach lessons to anyone, but I tried my best to put together what I had learned over some 20 years of work in this field. And if you have some capabilities, as I said, as a scientist, you can make model, you can use thermodynamics, you can try to quantify a little things that happen. It's not like a politician will say, well, things are not so good because some evil people is doing bad, they are doing bad things. So once we destroy the evil people, then everything will be fine. And that's unfortunately doesn't work so well. We can destroy the bad guy of the year, but then things don't improve. As you can say, the things do not get. So we are in a situation which is a little worrisome, to say the least. And I started writing this book. Didn't take me so long. I started at the beginning of this year, and I hoped it would be a theoretical exercise. Instead, it seems to be a description of things which are actually happening in the world. So anyway, you set me to tell a long story. Essentially, let me go back to some details. I was a chemist studying oil. Then I started to study the economics of oil, how it is extracted, produced, sold, the financial system, the perspectives for the future, what happens. Because oil, with the best of goodwill, that's not like farming. Farming, if you farm well, you never run out of soil. If you extract oil well, in a good manner, I'm meaning from you extract oil from a well, and you can extract it well. And if you do that, you run out faster of oil because oil is finite. There is no way to avoid it. And the big question from the viewpoint of a chemist is that this extraction of oil, that we extract oil, we burn it, and we move the products of combustion into the atmosphere, which is CO2. Carbon dioxide, that's a big, a huge, an enormous chemical reaction which is taking place all over the world. We are burning in enormous quantities of oil or gas and coal. It's fantastic. In terms of mineral production, it is the largest production in the world globally. It's only iron, maybe it's higher in terms of weight, but oil is really very important. Just think that about 30% of the ships that move over the oceans carry oil or gas or sometimes coal. So it's huge. And it is a chemical reaction which is having effects. If you see it from the viewpoint of an alien, imagine that you are an alien looking at Earth from space, and some chemical reaction is taking place down there. What are they doing there? They're burning something. There's smoke coming out. What is happening? And that's fascinating for a chemist, really, because it is having effects, big effects. The two things, climate change or global warming, if you prefer, and oil extraction and oil depletion and oil consumption and the civilization which is in between the two things, two related phenomena which are going in parallel, which is with each other. And just to finish this story about how I got here, I mean, in this path that I started walking more than 20 years ago, I found that some people had done a fantastic work of analyzing this big chemical reaction, enormous chemical reaction worldwide, global. And they used models which were very, very similar to chemical models we use, we chemists. They were not chemists, though. They were engineers, sociologists, and their work was called The Limits to Growth. You may have heard the title of this book. It is rather well known. It was published in 1972, so more than 50 years ago, and it was a beautiful study of a chemical reaction. A chemical reaction of humankind as a catalyst, oil as a reactant, and CO2, carbon dioxide, as a product. So we said, well, why are they doing that? But anyway, they are doing that. It's ghost burning. And already in 1972, they found that the trajectory of this reaction would go through a maximum point in which the reaction, like a flame, like burn something, and it goes off with a big flame. And then when you run out of wood or coal or gasoline, whatever you have, then it settles. It has to. And the maximum of this huge reaction with oil was to take place around 2010, 2020. Now, essentially, so we are at the top of this big, huge, enormous reaction, which is a fantastic moment in history, because first fantastic point is that they got it so right 50 years ago. Say, well, this thing is going to grow and then stop growing in about 50 years. And indeed, it is doing that. We are clearly reaching the limits first. And then I met the people who did this work, this famous work. Said, and I asked them, and then what happens? And they told me, we have no idea. Because, but whatever is going to happen, it is not going to be good, as you can see.
Yes.
And that's why I wrote a book dedicated to exterminations.
It almost seems to be an inbuilt instinct in groups of humans that when conditions get difficult, they find a way of rallying into different subgroups that then turn on each other to kind of fight over the remaining resources. And I mean, there are rare historic examples of alternatives to that, but it's definitely a dynamic that's worth considering as we kind of look into the future.
Yeah, that's what we can do. History is not exactly like chemistry. Chemistry has law, it has mathematical parameters and equations. History is much more difficult to deal with in mathematical terms. Some people do it. You may have heard a term which is becoming fashionable, which is called cryodynamics. Probably never heard of it. It's Clio is the name of a goddess, a muse, the muse of history. And so they say dynamics of a goddess. Somehow it becomes a set of equations. It's creative. No doubt about that. So one guy called Peter Turner, other people like Joseph Painter, they are very smart people. I am amazed when I discuss with them sometimes. They try to use mathematical equations to deal with history, which is very difficult but not impossible. If you read my book, you will find at the end a description of a paper that myself and my co-workers, so a couple of co-workers of mine, we wrote together, trying to analyze the patterns of war, which is extremely interesting. We were not the only ones doing that. It's a field, a whole field of science, so many people are working on that. But our conclusions, I think, were a little more extensive than those of other people, because we examined that a database of about 600 years, which is interesting. 600 years, it's even a little more. It goes back to the late Middle Ages. And then the question is, when people is there a reason? Is there a cause? Is there a periodicity of wars? Wars of exterminations are very similar things, actually, as obvious. And no, there is not. People, it's wars, violence is endemic, in the sense that you see it go up and down, like earthquakes, like rain, like landslides. It happens. It's the result of some tension which accumulates. People start accumulated rage, not like an earthquake accumulates energy. People enraged accumulate psychic energy, and they start hating other people, and then they accumulate, I hate them, I hate them, I hate them, and then eventually, bang, it
And
goes
you get a
kinetic.
localized positive feedback loop that when one person starts to act
When
on
one, but
that,
yeah,
they
exactly,
encourage
yeah,
other people
absolutely,
to join them and you end up with a mob or
absolutely,
a whole nation deciding to move.
enhancing feedback is a beautiful thing when it happens for good things, but when it happens for bad things, it's extremely bad, because when you start a war, as you know, It's we don't know how to stop wars.
Mm.
We don't know why we start wars, but we don't even know how to stop them. Right now, I think down in Palestine, in Gaza, in Lebanon, they want to stop, but they don't know how.
Yeah.
And that's a tragedy, actually. And unfortunately, all our science, it comes to nothing because we have no solution. We can describe what happens, but we have no real way, no effective way. As you see in my book, I try to describe a few ways that we could try. But when you are swept away by these waves of violence, it's extremely difficult to resist. Like you remember, surely you. How old were you when the 9/11,
I
2000?
was just about to start my PhD, so I would have
That's your
been in my
PhD.
early 20s, yeah.
So you remember that, as I remember that. It was a bit forgotten, but that moment was a big thing, and everybody got, oh, we have to fight. We have to fight the war on terror. War on terror. Nobody knew exactly what was the war on terror, but we started a war on terror. And now, fortunately, seems to have abated a little bit, but takes a lot of time. And there is a sentence that I found while researching for this book. And it was a British writer, whose name was McCaig, Charles McCaig. That you find this kind of thing written in mid-19th century. And he said he had this intuition, incredible intuition, say, you know what I notice? That people go mad altogether, but become sane again one by one. And it is an incredible intuition in mathematical terms, because if you use equations to model this behavior, then it's exactly what you find.
Do you suspect that the Iraq and Afghan invasions were the first major conflict that was sparked by television? Because like you had radio as a really important ingredient in the Nazi experience and Rwanda as well. And before that, you had witch burnings came from a book that everyone spread everywhere and read all at the same time.
Yes, you read
And
that.
yeah, if that is the pattern, do we have like internet and social media wars to think about as a future pattern?
And the whole thing goes so easily out of control. But the interesting point I'd say is that there is no need for something very sophisticated in terms of communication system like social media, television, during the. Yeah, not everybody knows, but the Germans had TV during the Second World War, and the Nazis were reasonably good in terms of propaganda, but they're not so good. And if you look at what they were doing at that time, they were amateurs. Really, it's very crude.
It's almost like an arms race between the propagandists and the people that they're
Yeah,
trying
no.
to manipulate, that we get
Propaganda always wins. Don't
well,
worry about that.
but over time, like the propaganda of the Second World War, would it work as well on modern audiences, or is it not sophisticated
Not today.
enough?
We had not
Yeah.
today. We have much more sophisticated propaganda techniques. But what is fascinating is that, I mean, the Germans of the 1930s, the time of the Nazis, the Hitler and all these people, they were sophisticated people. They were read people. They were cultured. They had university. They were one of the most cultured society in the world at that time, and they fell for such crude propaganda tricks. It's actually unbelievable. And all what was needed was the shock of having lost World War One. And people are weak. We are weak. You are weak. I am weak. We can easily fall for simple tricks.
So, do you have any thoughts on ways that societies could control that buildup of tension? And one historic example I can think of was the Aztec Empire that used to have flower wars. They would have these ceremonial wars that were designed to. They were basically like sporting events with beheadings at the end of them to kind of sublimate that anger and that rage between different people in their empire. And do you think something like that could emerge in the future?
Good point. It's you see again, when you study history using equations, you see that there are some rules. There is no way to describe history precisely with the questions. No way. You cannot say such day there will be a war, in 2 years it will be over, and then who will win, who will lose. But there are trends. Trends and equations, models can tell you a lot about how these trends develop. And one thing that you see is that there is a trend for history to stabilize. As you said, for the Aztecs, at the beginning, you get a big friction. Some group of people arrives, then they fight the people who were already in place, then they win, they lose, they restart, they kill each other. But eventually, there is a trend, a tendency to stabilize. It exists. There's no doubt about that. And we see this stabilization happening and sometimes becoming reasonably stable for a certain period. And it is interrupted by some specific factors, which may be, for instance, population. Some sections of a region becomes overpopulated. The people who live there decide, well, we want more food, more land, more women. Also, that's typical reason for war. And they attack, and then you start this oscillation, and it is very similar in mathematical terms to epidemics, pandemics. When you have a mutation, a new virus starts diffusing through the population. And you noted by the last pandemic that the first waves were a little more dangerous, a little more deadly than the later ones. And if we use vaccines, a lot of stuff we did, but eventually these things tend to stabilize. Even viruses, they don't, they're not made to kill people. They want to survive. And so in order for them to survive, they don't have to kill us. And that's the way they stabilize. It's the same for wars. Eventually, societies tend to stabilize. You have several examples in history of places, regions, governments, societies, states, which sort of created and maintained a certain stability for a certain time, reducing violence, sublimating it into forms of sport. Sometimes violent sports, like we do the same. I mean, our sports, we don't supposed to kill anyone, but sometimes it happens by mistake, by accident. So the Romans had, for instance, the gladiators games. But they were supposed to kill people sometimes, but we don't really know how deadly they actually were. So they were a way to sublimate, to give way out to the violence in a way which would not actually destroy things or destroy people. So other examples, Japan during the Shogun era. The Shogunate was a period of peace, about 250 years of no wars after a period, but the earlier period was a period of violence, a warlord period with all the samurais fighting each other and the movies and the ninjas and all these people. But it happened. So the question is whether we can arrive to a stabilization. But in our case, it is very difficult because we have a problem with resources and with pollution. The models we have, they tell us that we go through this growing curve and then they fall down, which is called, you cannot see this here, but
The Seneca effect, yes.
I have a t-shirt when as I am speaking, showing exactly the curve that I call the Seneca curve, which I gave it his name from something that the Roman philosopher Seneca said about 2,000 years ago. He said, "Wow, what a strange thing I noted." So things grow slowly and then decline rapidly. Ruin is rapid, he said, which is true. He didn't know about system dynamics, model calculations, but you don't need to know that to understand that it's easy to build a house of cards. No, it takes time. Not easy. It takes time to build a house of cards, and then just a little hit, and then it goes down all in a heap.
But for
So,
the industrial era, I think it really helps to look back to like the second half of the medieval period, featured extensive
also.
mechanization. There were water wheels and windmills and all sorts of complicated pre-industrial technology being built up gradually during that time. And then it was turbocharged when coal was added to the foundation of that structure. But yeah, the industrial
Absolutely,
era
it's
has deep roots.
typical. Absolutely, you have a technology. Technology is like a mutation in a virus. Technology is a mutation in the industrial system. You have something new, something that expands, takes over, destroys what was there before. Coal destroyed wood, crude oil destroyed coal, and then we go through these big changes. And we are going through these oscillations. Now there is a new oscillation which is caused by renewable energy taking over in the system. And it got to be seen if we have enough time and enough resources to have this contrast and in certain way, yeah, as much as possible, compensate for the depletion of fossil fuels. And if that can happen before climate change really destroys us, because really we are at this risk. And that's why things are so difficult now to model, to understand, to predict. We have nice models, beautiful models. I've been working with these models by now for 20 years. It's a lot of fun. You enjoy yourself, but there are two problems. First, you can make the best model in the world, and nobody will believe you. Nobody who has the power to do something, actually. Go to Mr. Trump and tell him, I have a sophisticated model telling you about what we should go for the American economy in order to make America great again. But I'm not sure he would listen to a modelist like me or somebody, many better modelist than I am. But no, the idea now, the whole political idea is let's make America great again. How? Well, okay, then we'll think about that. You see, it's where there is a will, there is a way, but it may be a little difficult.
Getting back to
And
history, do you think that there might be parallels with today's globalized kind of corporate industrial system with the state of Rome after it had beaten, won in the Punic Wars, it had beaten Carthage and it had a monopoly access to the Mediterranean for trade? And
that's a point.
After that point, there were no more really major wars with like identifiable enemies. It was mostly about disintegration and civil wars, that holding that huge structure together was the challenge, rather than having like, I know China gets kind of, painted as the boogeyman in that next big, world war conflict, but I'm not sure we actually have the resources and the demographics and the deep political schisms anymore to actually have anything like a world war. I think we're so interwoven that the only thing that can happen is those smaller conflicts and disintegrations.
You have it. You have it. Exactly. That's the point. The Roman Empire went through a cycle which was very similar to what we expect our cycle will be. Just as a fun thing. I had this intuition about the Roman Empire that was about 10 years ago. We were having a meeting about modeling, system dynamic modeling in a little resort in the mountains of Italy, in Italy. And I was preparing my talk about this calculation. And then I thought, there's something very similar at the Roman Empire, because not my invention, but I found a paper by Swedish or Norwegian, not sure, guy who had used the same equations to provide a sketchy model of the Roman Empire. So this is a good idea. That works. So I went to this place, and then I went up on the conference. I said, "Friend, Romans, fellow citizens, I'm not here to And so that was a great moment for me, and it works, because really it's like, as I was making a comparison with epidemics, it's not very different. Every epidemic has a different virus or a different bacterium, but the process is very much the same. You have a new virus somewhere, starts, grows, goes through, and then disappears. Always the same. And it is the same for societies. Big societies go through very similar cycles, except for, there are exceptions, of course, but Rome still teaches us so much about our situation. We are now in a situation in which the empire has grown more or less as much as it could, and now it is facing decline. There is no doubt about that. And we are trying to do what we can, but you were perfectly right when you said we don't have any more the human resources that would be needed to start a real full-size Third World War. And there is another point, if you like, I could try to propose it, but you probably read that the Romans were, at least in part, destroyed by mercury poisoning. Did you know this story? The story that they used to drink wine from leaden cups, and lead and mercury, they were also metal, heavy metals. And we have the same problem, but metals. So the Romans, the late Roman Empire, had a huge problem of manpower. Huge, because the fertility of the population had gone down, possibly because of this heavy metal poisoning. Probably. We don't have quantitative data. We cannot prove this kind of interpretations, but it could be. Now, compare with our situation now. If you look at what's happening, is that humans, males, for instance, that's something easy to measure, they are losing about 2% of their sperm count per year. Now, make a calculation, and you see that in 50 years, there won't be any more children if it keeps going like this, and nobody knows why. Just like the Romans didn't know why they had this population problem. They're not enough people.
I made a Substack post a while ago that hypothesized that cities function like predators. That all through history until I think the 1800s, cities were a net population sink, that people would have children in the countryside that there wasn't quite enough room for, and the surplus would migrate to the cities hoping for some opportunity. And they would mostly fail, at least in terms of Darwinian terms. They wouldn't produce enough children to replace themselves. So you had this ecosystem basically where the farmlands were like the herbivores, and the cities were like lions and wolves that kind of kept the two in balance. And
Good point. Good point.
that pattern was broken with the Industrial Revolution, because we could suddenly move all of this food and water into cities and get all of the waste products out in a way that we never could before. But it's almost like they're returning to that role, because there is so much urbanization of populations
Polluted.
around the world, and that's a big driver of the demographic collapse that we're experiencing.
Exactly. You had a good point. I hadn't thought in these terms before, but I think you are right. You're right. It's because we depopulated the countryside and put all the population inside cities, which is an unhealthy environment, not so much because of the kind of pollution or waste that was typical of Middle Ages or the Industrial Revolution, but because of pollution. Pollution in terms of gases. And there is your body, my body, everybody's body is now contaminated, not so much by heavy metals, but are also heavy metals. But we are polluting ourselves by some substances which didn't exist before, like fluoroalkylates, like chromatic molecules, nanoplastics. You know that we have about 0 point something percent of nanoplastics in our brains. And I think this explains a few things, don't you think so? Oh, but really, we have this sub. Sure, go ahead.
It makes me wonder what are going to be the major forces that get our enormous population back towards something that's sustainable in a post-industrial resource base. And I wonder, like, people like to think about, these huge wars and all this running around and screaming and dying. And I wonder if it might actually be a relatively quiet affair for the most part. It could be mostly driven by this demographic trend, and people are responding rationally to the decreasing resource base by having fewer children. And that people often talk about the power of exponential growth surprising people, but it works for exponential decline. Just a few percent decline every year adds up much faster than people realize.
Exactly. That you are we're going to see. I told you about the Seneca effect. The Seneca effect, growth is low, but ruin is rapid. Holds also for population. Once population starts collapsing, it collapses very fast. And it will. There is a, but in Italy, in it's already happening, and that's compensated by immigration. I don't think it is the same in Australia,
Oh
but
yes,
you are
we've
played
got record in we've
a
got
land of
record immigration.
immigrants. You had
we're going through
many
a
Italians.
Well, that was back in that time. But yeah, we're having very high levels of immigration at the moment to
Okay.
try and make the economic numbers make sense for a system that was built with the assumption of growth.
And then you see, we people, when discuss about politics of immigration, you heard Mr. Trump what he said yesterday, and the politics is a silly game in my opinion, because it is the same happening in Italy, and I figure it is similar also in Australia, because the right says the immigration is bad. And they should be limited, and we have to throw these ugly people back into the sea, and that's right. The left is not so much better. He said, "Well, no, there is no problem. We just turn them into Italians, or turn them into good Australians, or good Americans." But they don't see the problem exists, and no one, left or right, thinks, "Hey, but won't it be a chemical problem by any chance? Won't be something wrong that we eat, drink, or breathe that destroys the capability of those people who have been living for a longer time in a polluted environment, Westerners, you Australians, I don't know if you consider yourselves as Westerners, but maybe. And if it is a chemical problem, it is useless to vote right or left. You have to do something to stop pollution. But this is not in the political agenda. And so it's,
It's much
and
harder to tell a story about it that resonates with the masses.
and anyway, we have to go in the direction where the system takes us. We can discuss as much as we want, we can make models, we can explain to people, but the problem is, some problems are really very difficult. The demographic problem has not been understood so much so far. And it because it is difficult, because some people correctly say, "No, okay, Mr. Bardi, you're a chemist. You're a chemist. You see only chemistry." And I will tell them, "But you are a sociologist. You see only sociology." But people, because problems are complex. People, it is perfectly reasonable to say, people, couples in the West are not having children for socioeconomic reasons. It is reasonable. Or it is also reasonable to say, no, they are not having children because they can't, because they try, but it doesn't work. Probably both reasons are at work.
I would love to get your thoughts on the possible interactions between fossil fuel supply limits and climate change projections, because I think a lot of the worst case scenario models for climate change assume that we just have more and more fossil fuels to burn all the way up to the end of the century. And I haven't seen many people do modeling where you take both of those into account to figure out what the balance of those impacts is going to be, because they kind of get in each other's way.
And in a way, yes, there is a story. There is a long story, but it remained confined within groups of specialists. It was already I think more than 10 years, 20 years ago, people started to say, hey, the climate problem is not so bad because we are running out of fossil fuels. But the problem is that it is a very interdisciplinary story. And then climatologists are good people, but they know nothing about fossil fuel depletion. Fossil fuel people sometimes were dumb enough that they used this idea to say, oh, this is all a hoax, it is a fake story, this is climate change, there won't be a problem. And then it remains, it was not solved, it was never solved. Eventually peak oil story went off the radar, and it's not being talked anymore. But one thing is clear to me, I've been working on this subject for quite a while, that we are starting to go through the cliffs for the fossil fuels. There's no doubt about that. We start, I mean, this thing don't happen in weeks, don't happen in months, not even in years, but in decades, yes. Less than one decade from now, we will be going down so fast that you will lose your hat in the process. There is no doubt about that. Problem is, will that save us from global warming? And that's very uncertain. I honestly don't know. It could be extremely bad. Could be deadly. Say we are walking dead, as you know. Could be not so bad. Could be even marginal. But we don't know. The data we have are just not sufficient. So we are gambling with humankind's future. If it is. There is not much that we can do about that. Even if we wanted to stop using fossil fuel tomorrow, it would not be possible. We'll kill, I don't know how many billion people. So we cannot do that. The best we can do is to try to limit consumption. But that's easy because it will limit itself. Depletion will do the job for us. Will it be sufficient? Good question.
So next, Ugo, I was really fascinated in your book by your three ingredients that seem to be necessary for historical exterminations to take place. And I don't want to tread over that territory because I recommend people read the book. You have so much fascinating historical analysis of those three ingredients that are necessary for groups to be attacked by the dominant culture. But I do want to see if we can explore how those rules can be applied to online communities in these days. And do you want to have a go at bouncing around
Yeah,
those
let's
ideas?
try. There's so many things to discuss. When you discuss exterminations, you go into the way of behaving of human beings that we think we should be good. Humans are supposed to be good, but they're not. And in some circumstances, they are quite a lot bad, horrible, actually. So I didn't deal so much in my book about virtual states. Once you study the subject of how humans misbehave with each other, then the three laws of extermination came out by themselves. Because in order to exterminate a group, first of all, you have to have a group. To people to exterminate, this group must be recognizable. The Germans in the 1930s and 40s, they could not say we exterminate the Jews, but the Jews were a recognizable entity, people who could be recognized because of some also physical traits that they had. And second thing, you have to gain something by because exterminating people is expensive. You have some spend some resources. So it's you this subgroup has to be relatively wealthy or at least have something that you want at the very minimum, like for the Native Americans, as we call them Indians, although you should not use the term anymore, but the Native Americans had the land that the whites wanted. They were not rich, but they had the land. So you have to get something back in return. And then finally, it has to be possible. It has to be a relatively weak minority that cannot offer a substantial military resistance. So that's for the real world. You have several examples in my book. I think I have five or six, but if you go through history, you will find tens or maybe hundreds of cases of small communities, smaller communities, being having been exterminated or anyway harassed and mistreated. In the case of virtual communities, is another story. I mention it in my book, but I don't go so much into details because it's something so new that we don't really know how to deal with it. We know that there are several proposals. Some virtual communities exist, of course. People recognize themselves in some kind of virtual communities. They frequent the groups, the chatting groups, the social media, and all those kind of things. But let's say that they are not so solid, so easily recognizable, and that you cannot frame them in the same way that you would frame a group which is, for instance, racially recognizable, right? Like blacks, for instance, or the American Indians, they were also racially and linguistically recognizable. So the virtual communities are much more fluid, which makes it a different kind of problem. But there has been the proposal, and this I discuss in the book, the proposal of turning these loose social media communities into real full-fledged states, which they could have their money, virtual money. All money is virtual. That's not a problem. You have it already. It's when you have the likes in your social platform, they're a form of money. Well, now you cannot use to buy anything, but that could be changed. It is not such a big problem. And you could have an organization, you could have a government, you could have a police in the real world, and a virtual police as well, maybe a virtual army and also a real army. Is it possible? It has been proposed. It doesn't mean that it is possible. We still have to see that the closest thing that we have now to a virtual state, a state which has no borders, no territory, no fixed territory. And it's a corporation. Corporations, say, think of Exxon, think of Musk's empire of X and Tesla and whatever he has of the SpaceX and et cetera.
I would suggest Apple is probably the closest Apple to being
also,
a proto-nation.
Oh, Apple, and Microsoft, Google,
well,
and
Apple
Facebook.
Apple has the people who are Apple enthusiasts pride themselves on being distinct from, you know, the people who just use Microsoft because it's the majority, and they develop a very clean aesthetic. Like there are religious notes to the
yeah,
whole
that's
Apple
right, that's
community.
Right. You have a good point. I didn't think so much about that because I always hated Apple personally. I am more a Microsoft person in the sense that I never fell for this marketing trick that you buy something, you make yourself different than the others, right? You buy Gucci shirt, and so you are because, but it's so easy to trick people. Human mind is so easily plasmable. It's you. They can play a lot of tricks with your mind. So it is possible. As I was telling you in another before we started the interview, I think that Mr. Musk is planning right now to buy the United States, which is, I don't know, how much would you pay for the United States? How much do you think the United States is worth?
Do you take on all of its debts at the same time when you pick up the keys?
You know the movie The Kingdom of Heaven? At some point there is a line that the Christian king handles, gives the Jerusalem to the Muslim king because he won, and says, how much do you think Jerusalem is worth? Salah ad-Din says nothing and everything. It's a good point for a state, because a state or a city is worth nothing in itself, but it's everything, actually. It is this frame that makes your life possible. So it's worth nothing and it is worth everything. But it is possible to buy not the state, but the structures that compose it.
Yeah.
And so you can buy the government, not the state.
You reminded me of a paper I read recently, or a blog post, suggesting that a Facebook group functions like a feudal fiefdom, that there's usually one admin who is in control, and all they can really do is to exile, which is kind of like executing people who don't
Yeah,
accord with that
that's.
community. Like there's very little power to retrain or restrain individuals. All they can do is basically chop their head off and kick them out of the group.
Yeah,
And it
those does not states, those are tribes. Tribes, you have a certain leeway. If you don't like your boss in a tribe, you leave, and if you establish your own tribe or you join another tribe, it's a different kind of world. In a state, you cannot do that. You're a citizen of Australia, I'm a citizen of Italy. I can not easily change my citizenship. And so it's a different kind of slavery, because I really cannot. There are many things I cannot do as an Italian, and I figure also for your case as an Australian, you can plenty of things you cannot do, or you can do that I cannot do, and vice versa.
It's tricky
So
because the
it's.
stakes are so low. Like when you're excluding someone from a virtual group, you're not killing them, you're not taking real property. So because it's stake the stakes are so low, people do that very freely. I'm kind of reminded of the French Revolution when the guillotine was this new scientific blind way of killing people. So they went crazy using it because the previous methods were kind of horrific. And now we, oh no, your head just comes clean off. It's not that bad. Stop complaining. So they
Yeah,
felt entitled to use
that's
it a
a good
lot more.
point. I had not thought about that. Yeah, good point. And we don't kill people in virtually. You are virtually killed, but you are still alive. So there is, fortunately, the web is much wider than there is no borders, no evident borders. So nothing prevents you from making your own state on the web, your own
Yeah,
group, your own.
anyone's free to create their own group, but
Yeah,
it's not the land that's limiting, it's the citizens. You have to encourage other people to come and follow you as a fiefdom.
yeah, that's of course you start your own state on the web, and you discover you are alone. At least you don't have problems with the majority, because you are the majority. But it is the very strong point, the point which is being discussed now. Can we make the state as a borderless entity? No fixed borders, and so you, the state is defined, but your allegiance, your fealty to a person or to a group of person or to a specific idea, at that point it becomes a little like a party, a political party, which they don't exist anymore in the form they were a few decades ago. Right now, they're essentially gone. But once you swore allegiance to the Communist Party, for instance, you had a card, the card of the Communist Party. You were a communist, you were supposed to be loyal to the Communist Party. And why not? I mean, it is out of fashion right now, but it could return, because things always return in history.
The other thing in virtual spaces is that the wealth that is being fought over is kind of meager. Like if you're just like likes aren't actually worth very much, views aren't worth very much. The only thing that could possibly be different to that is digital currencies, which are still a kind of unknown quantity about what the impact would be. Do you have any thoughts about the
I have
potential?
many thoughts about that, but I don't know whether my thoughts are right or are better than the thoughts of anybody else, because really we're moving in a very difficult and uncertain territory. We don't know exactly. We don't. We have been studying economics for at least, I'd say, 3 centuries. But still, if you ask an economist what is exactly money, I'm not sure he can answer with, or she can answer with some certainty, because what is money exactly? We have this thing, it's so important, so unbelievably important, but what is it?
It's
And
elusive.
that
And
comes to something
virtual
that
a digital money is even more elusive.
it's the same thing. Depends who guarantees for it. It's an agreement that you have that money is some kind of points that somehow define your identity, your power, your capability, your prestige. Once you say that, you are still left with a problem about how do you manage this thing? We do for money. We do things that we would never do for nothing else, except killing oneself is about. Just about the only thing you would not do, no matter how much you're paid. But
It's
But
a paradox with digital currencies too, because in one way they're so elusive, but in the other they're so dependent on this really, really complicated foundation, this highly technological foundation, which if you look at peak oil and possible end of industrial civilization, it may not be around for that much longer.
because money exists because you can buy something with money. And you notice that for instance, in the Middle Ages in Europe, the economy had crashed so badly that there was nothing to buy. But there was no money. Money disappeared. The people who had gold found that this gold was worthless. What do you buy? If you cannot buy anything, well, gold is useless. And so they buried the gold underground. And that's the origin, by the way, of the legends of dragons and the hidden treasures. I think the European economy restarted around the 9th century when some silver mines were discovered in Eastern Europe, and then the economy gradually restarted to move, and then there was a new movement of monetary movement, and there was a period of about 3 4 centuries that money didn't really exist. It was not a bad period. I think we should think about that because really was a reasonably peaceful and prosperous period for Europe. Unfortunately, it did not last. Money corrupts everything.
I had another interesting radical thought for identifiability in online spaces that you could, and this kind of applies in the real world too. But a culture that's aware of the three rules of extermination could engage in like a performance of being more normal than they really are. And you could do that online too, using AI to click on websites like it's you doing it, just looking at all the normal things that normal people are supposed to do online. And if everybody did that, it could actually like ruin the ability for governments to like monitor internet activity to understand what's going on, because everyone just seems to be doing normal things. There's nothing happening
That's
that's.
right. You could do that too. It's, we are a moment, an extremely fluid moment. We don't know what's going to happen because Bitcoin, virtual currency, or it's so new that it has not yet had a serious impact. Virtual states are an idea which has been proposed, but we don't know whether they will actually exist. And artificial intelligence that you mentioned, so far, honestly, is a joke, but one of those jokes that risk to become reality, because really this thing is powerful, very powerful, if it can work, because we don't know. It's
It could
we
also
have
just completely pollute our culture and swamp out
polluter
any real
culture could
signal.
crash by itself. We could find some problems that make it impossible to work the way it is supposed to work, because the big problem is that it runs on itself. It's if in artificial intelligence makes a mistake, then that mistake remains in the memory of that artificial intelligence. The artificial intelligence continues to rely on
Amplify
that
the mistake,
mistake, and there is to amplify it. And really, if you try to use artificial intelligence for scientific research, you see that it is a disaster complete, and it just doesn't work. No way. It can help a little if you ask what is the capital of Madagascar, and we'll tell you probably reliably what is the capital of Australia. I don't know actually.
Oh, it's Canberra, but nobody goes there.
Nobody knows about that. Yeah, you're right. I if you had asked me, I would say Sydney, but it's Canberra. Yeah, that's right. Like the capital of the state of New York, it is not New York.
Now, I'm also interested to explore how these three principles for exterminations could apply to regional agricultural communities that are adapting to the end of industrial civilization. So if people might understand this dynamic that when you live in a little rural town out in the middle of nowhere, everybody knows everyone else's business. These social pressures can be much more intense because it's not like a city where you can just disappear and like ignore people. If you've made a mistake socially, it tends to hang around. And they feel like the kind of environments where exterminations, at least small scale exterminations, are more possible or probable. Like one family that doesn't get along with everyone else is going to have a really hard time. So, yeah, I don't know if you have some thoughts about how.
No, I think this is a question that can be answered because we have a historical example, which is the Roman Empire. When the Roman Empire collapsed, the economy was turned from, well, never was an industrial economy. It was essentially a military economy, but military means industrial because they had all sorts of facilities for production, food production, control, bureaucracy, the state, etc. So the whole thing collapsed around the 5th century of our era, and then European society transformed, changed into a rural society, like you described, the small communities scattered over relatively scarcely populated landscape. So it was not so bad. As for what I can say, what I read about this period of transition, it was not peaceful. There have never been periods of peace in human, long-standing periods of peace in human history, but it was not so terrible because there were not sufficient resources to make really big wars. And at that point, after a difficult phase, the Roman Empire went through several convulsions, up and down, and emperors and things, and we reconquer and we go there. The legions will be coming back, and the barbarians coming down, and then et cetera, et cetera. But relatively peaceful, not so terrible. Because to make a war, you need resources. You need an army. You need to pay an army. The Roman Empire collapsed when the mines, gold and silver mines, collapsed. They have no more money to pay the army, and no more money. You cannot keep a functioning economy. So you cannot pay, even if you could print money. Fine, you can do that, but you can if there is nothing to buy, money is worthless. So an army cannot exist. The Roman army disappeared, evaporated. Really, it's an interesting story. Already in the beginning of the 5th century, the first sack of Rome, at some moment there was no more army. People said, "Where is the army? We have to defend Rome, the barbarians. Where is the army? What the hell happened?" Disappeared. And that was necessary because if you have no money, no army. And so I think this is a possible line of development that we'll see in the future, the disappearance of armies, because if you see how much war costs now, can you imagine how much a war like the war in Ukraine, 3 years of war, but it's unbelievable how much money it must have cost. Somebody has to pay for that. I'm afraid that it will be us, but that's another story. What I can note from the experience of 15 centuries ago is that very small communities could not survive. Communities which were very small. The Roman countryside was made of villas, patronal villas of big men who had an agricultural enterprise, but they did not survive. We find the ruins of these villas because there were bad people, marauders or bandits or brigands or whatever you had.
I
And
think I read
those.
somewhere that the slaves that were running those big estates, when the
Yes,
barbarians
yes.
turned up, they're like, "This isn't my place. I'm not defending it.
Yeah,
I'm
that's
just
right. That's
I'm just
also that. Also
I've got
that.
no
Whatever it
incentive."
happened, we have plenty of ruins of small estates that could not be defended from just hooligans or bad people running in the countryside. But if you had a small town, then you could defend it, and then you could have a functioning economy on a very small scale, a castle economy. Like we have this idea of the Middle Ages, there were castles in the countryside, but well, that's so wrong because really you could have an economy working on a scale, a town of maybe even 1,000 people was enough during that time, maybe even less. But you had to have some defense structure because otherwise you could not survive. You could not survive with a farm in the middle of nowhere. You had to have a castle defending a farm. And that was the Middle Ages, essentially. It's novelized because there's not it was not so simple. There were towns, there were armies, there were barbarians, there were kings, all sorts of things. But essentially, the economy was reduced to a very small scale series of agricultural feuds, small landlords who owned small estates in a network of alliances with the near neighbors, and it worked. It was relatively peaceful. We may see something like that. The mistake that modern people who think they can survive in a small community, I think, in my opinion, I might be wrong, but they may do it too small. If you have 10 people, even 1,000 people, in my opinion, too small. You cannot survive. If you have something good, 1,000 people, somebody will come there, kill you all, and take whatever you have. You need something bigger.
What are your thoughts on how geography influences this capacity to like recover from civilizations collapsing? I'll make the contrast between the Ukraine, which is very fertile, very flat, and seems to constantly be having another army marching through it, against the Basque region, which is fertile valleys up in the mountains, and they basically survived the Roman Empire. Like they're still there in a relatively un.
And I think Ireland or Australia also is sort of defendable, I think, because you cannot be easily invaded. Actually, you were invaded at least by the Westerners, but now you are the invaders. You are a descendant of the invaders, so you can. But again, we have to see which places will be better than others. That's very difficult to predict right now. If you live in an island, again, it may be too small. You cannot defend it. Ireland was an interesting case because in a certain period it was very good to be in Ireland because it was small, isolated, separated by the sea, and so they were essentially spared all the invasions that crashed onto Europe. But then they were too small. In the 17th century, one guy called Cromwell came in and killed most of them and took over. So it's probably the size of England is better. Britain, more exactly, because they were invaded too. But anyway, that was a more difficult task. But life is not easy. Humans are aggressive. And they are not peaceful. That's one of the big problems we have for the, I think I don't know. We may go back to an agricultural society, subsistence agricultural society, like the Middle Ages in Europe. It could be. It is possible. It would not be so bad, I think. Or we may go, okay, keep going.
On the rules of extermination, if you wanted to join a community like the Basques, would you be better off doing it as an individual, finding a way to marry into a family, rather than moving your whole family into a community? Because as just one person, you're not really as identifiable. And whereas if you're a family that moves in, you're distinct, at least in the first generations from the surrounding community, that there's more of a risk
That's
during that
again a
transition.
good point. I have experience. There are a few communities in Italy and in Europe who will normally accept you if you want to join, and you have to bring your capabilities and these communities have normally some more social structures than ordinary society, like we are used to in the West or in the Western style society. For instance, there are common kitchens, and you don't use money within the community. You exchange goods and services, but not using money. But if you some members work for externally, bring money to the community. At this point, it becomes what we call a monastery. It is a monastery, and it is the way still monasteries work. You join a monastery as a monk or a nun, and you are part of the community. You don't use money anymore within the community. The community will provide shelter, food, clothing, and whatever you need in exchange with what you can give. The community, the monasteries are an example of communism on a small scale. Communism didn't work so well on a large scale, but you know, monks and nuns have been around for a couple of thousand years, so it can work.
Yeah.
There is right now, you can find it on the web, a return of monastery, the idea of monastic life. Have you noticed that? I don't know if there is something like that in Australia, but here, yes, absolutely, yes, there is a return of interest, a remarkable return of interest.
It feels like we're on the verge of a period of cultural and social experimentation in response to all of the pressures from industrial civilization coming to an end. That it's such a, well, I mean, it's a time in history where one person can come up with a set of ideas that is more than the sum of its parts. Saint Benedict is a really good example as the founder of the monastic movement in Europe, that he was one person who experienced a few different attempts at monasteries and put together basically a rule book that other people could use to make their own monasteries.
Would that be possible now? I don't know, but this is a very interesting idea. Somebody could come up with a workable idea for a new kind of monastic life. That's a very interesting point. So far, I don't think there is anything like that, but it could appear.
Yeah.
It would be, excuse me, extremely interesting.
Well, that's probably a really great note to wrap things up on. Do you want to give us a final pitch for where people can check out your work? I know you've written lots of books and you're very active online. So drop all your links and where would you recommend people check out more of your work?
Well, thank you, Shane. My book is called Exterminations, and it is available on Amazon, which is not everybody likes Amazon. It is another feudal entity that people sometimes despise. But it's I think honestly, Amazon is doing a good job in making it possible for authors who are a little bit outside the mainstream, like me, to publish books, which I think some people I had some return, some comments on my book. Some people liked it. That's the satisfaction, because I don't think in our times nobody can make money on books. But it is good to do something that people can appreciate, and maybe they can learn something from my books or from books people who spend their times writing books. So I hope that if you are interested in the future, and you think that the key of the future is in the past, then it is an approach that we can use to try to understand what's happening to us, to our descendants, and to the whole world around us. And my book, Extermination, is an attempt to examine a facet of humankind which is not the brightest one, but it's something that we have to consider. We have to face reality. We cannot just ignore the things that we don't like. Otherwise, the things we don't like will not ignore us.
Yes. Yeah. And for people who are hesitant, I would say I found the book absolutely delightful. The way you approached this very difficult and dark topic was just thoroughly charming and entertaining. So yeah, go and check it out. I thoroughly recommend. And yeah, with that, Professor Ugo Bardi, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
And thank you for your interest. It was a pleasure.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.